Hello everyone, and thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of the Nutrition Nourishment Podcast, a podcast where I talk with my guests about their nutrition journeys and expertise to learn about the latest research and empower us in making sustainable, enjoyable lifestyle choices. I'm Amelia, a registered associate nutritionist with 5 years of nutrition study and work experience behind me. I'm now working as a dietetic assistant in the NHS and a freelance nutritionist. As always, nothing which is said on this podcast should be taken as personalised advice. If you'd like nutrition advice, you can contact a registered nutritionist or dietitian. It is a delight today to welcome my guest, Dr. Heather McKee, who is a leading behaviour change expert. Her mission is to offer an evidence-based, sustainable alternative to an industry saturated with quick fixes. In this episode, we spoke all about what a habit is, why so many of us struggle with habit formation, and advice for how we can build healthy, sustainable habits. Welcome to the Nutrition Nourishment Podcast. Hi, Heather.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good.
It's lovely to see you today. How has your day been so far?
Yeah, really nice. I had a really hectic one yesterday. Yes, I'm excited to do this today.
Well, it's lovely to be joined by you today. Would you start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm Irish. I've spent a long time in academia, I suppose, studying behaviour change, trying to understand what it takes to not only get people to change their behaviours, but importantly, maintain their behaviours long term. And now I run my business and I help companies and individuals find joy in their healthy habits. So I do workshops, I work with apps, and I have an online program, Bite-Size Habits course, that helps support people create changes that are going to help support them to have happier and healthier lives.
Amazing. It's so lovely to hear a bit about you, and I'm sure we're going to dive into all of that throughout the podcast. But going back into your academia, where did your interest in that begin?
Great question. I think when, this is going to sound silly, but even when you're younger, the back page of a magazine or a paper always has a day in the life of someone. And I was always fascinated about people's routines, people's habits, and trying to understand more. And when I was in university, my undergrad first, I worked in a metabolic syndrome clinic. We were working with patients that had diabetes and heart disease and various aspects of metabolic syndrome. And we had specific nutrition plans that we could give them. We had really good personal trainers. But it was quite interesting because people couldn't really seem to make the habits stick. And it's incredibly frustrating because I'd learned all this in university. Oh, these are all the great things about having a healthy lifestyle. And I was so sick about it. But yeah, these people had so many barriers. I actually ended up sitting down with each person in the clinic. I think there were 60 people and I had a chat with them all and just wanted to know what's going in the way, why are you finding this difficult? And that really just kind of, that was the spark that ignited the fire. And I got really interested in human behavior after that, and then was lucky enough to get go on to do a master's and get a scholarship to go and do a PhD in it. So yeah, you could say I never really left university. I was definitely there for 10, 11 years. Yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful time. And it was a wonderful platform to really understand more about what makes humans tick and what it takes to create lasting change.
So interesting. So your first degree, correct me if I'm wrong, that was in sports science or within that realm. Do you think trying to implement some of the things that you learned during that degree is what led you into behaviour change?
Yeah, I would say so. I went on then to lecture sports science students in St. Mary's University in Twickenham and in behaviour change. And because it was something that we touched on, and I did my thesis in psychology and about my undergrad and my master's, but it was something that I just felt so passionate about and really wanted to support other students in understanding more, because a lot of them were, you know, they would say to me, well, we know all the things to do, but when you go out into the real world, and a lot of students, you know, who graduate sports science, they won't be all working with elite athletes. They'll be working with people with metabolic syndrome or people, me and you, or our parents or your cousins or your aunties or anything like that. And so behavior change psychology is so important and so relevant to those key pieces of people's lives. And it's really important to be able to support everyone, not just top athletes, in terms of actually creating that change in their lives. And for a lot of people who study sports science, the majority of their clients won't yeah, won't be. It's important that they understand the psychology behind all of our normal everyday behaviour.
Exactly. So after you'd done that sports science degree and you'd gained some work experience, you mentioned that you've gone on to do a master's. What was that?
That was in physical activity and health psychology. So it's quite interesting because of course I would say that I was interested, maybe no one else. My undergraduate thesis was in high risk men. So men that were from low socioeconomic backgrounds and were at high risk for depression and suicide. And we were looking at exercise interventions that might help them manage better. And we were comparing if exercising on your own versus exercising in a group. So we had set up these football interventions that had CBT sprinkled into them. And we're seeing if one was better at kind of preventing exacerbations in depression and anxiety that we see in these groups. And that was really fascinating for me and kind of got me really interested in the psychology side of things. So when I went into my master's, then I looked at psychology of sedentary behavior, and actually are people who are more sedentary more prone to anxiety or depression or various mental health issues as well. And so yeah, that was something that I was really motivated to engage with as well. And I was also super excited about university. So it was Loughborough University, which is kind of one of the big ones in terms of health behavior, certainly at the time anyway, back in the day. But yeah, I was super excited to go there as well and learn more from some of the top professors, arguably in the world on these various areas.
It's so interesting to hear about that research. And how did your journey in academia continue after your master's?
Well, yeah, I was lucky enough to win a scholarship to go and study at the University of Birmingham in the psychology of weight, which has always been something that ever since I ran that clinic, it's just fascinated me. And it was all about how do we lose weight without dieting? So how do we support people with the key skills, the knowledge and the confidence to be able to execute on their goals and maintain their goals long term? And when I was there, we did multiple different studies on how do people manage multiple goals at once? Can they manage multiple goals at once? What are the key differences between those that are successful at long-term maintenance versus those that actually end up regaining weight or falling off the wagon with their healthy habits? And we created a really cool study and using an app as well, where we looked at when people were most tempted and why in their day, and actually what led people off track and why they gave in to certain temptations. And it was quite interesting actually, Amelia, because we found that most people were tempted at the same time of day. So it would tend to be around 3:30 or 8:30 at night, which I'm sure resonates with a lot of people. And it was interesting that the temptations sparked up, but each person had their own kind of pattern of temptations and then across the board. And key reasons were kind of boredom, stress, frustration, maybe length of time between previous meal. People had let themselves go hungry, they were more vulnerable to temptation. But it was really fascinating. Yeah, I would say that obviously. I loved it. I found it fascinating. And then we went on to create a weight loss group in low socioeconomic areas and look at if we trained one group of people in normal diet and exercise advice that you would get in a typical weight loss group, and then no psychological advice. And then the other group, we trained only in psychological skills, and we gave them no diet and exercise advice. And the interesting thing was that both groups lost the same amount of weight. But what was really interesting was that those that were in the psychology only group, they had better, they had increases in self-esteem and self-confidence, they had decreases in anxiety, decreases in depression, increases in mindful awareness, really, really interesting. And we actually didn't do anything. We told them not to, you know, mess with their diets, not to exercise more, not to do anything in that time. So we were really just trying to isolate why psychological skills might be beneficial for people. And that's not to say you should have one or the other. It's just to really look at, well, what is the effective one? And then you'd want to kind of bring in the other gradually as well.
It's so important to support our mental health with increasing our quality of life. And your study just shows that. But as you say, when we do research, you have to like split them out to make it a very clear, this is what the intervention is doing. But when we apply it to real life, we can have a bit of both and we can interchange both of those different supportive mechanisms for supporting people with making long-term and sustainable changes.
Yeah, definitely. No, I agree.
I had a question about some of your research, which was identifying people's triggers, which maybe didn't help them maintain habits. And that you said that there was that 3:30 or 8:30 were common times for those triggers to happen. Would helping us identify what those triggers are, as you said, boredom or stress, would identifying those triggers then help us overcome them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's something I tell everyone to do. I say you can do this so easily yourself. So anyone who's listening might want to do this. I've done this myself. I've piloted anything that I do, I've piloted it on myself, because I strongly believe it's important to practice what you preach. So, but yeah, so all you have to do is over the course of a week, or if a week feels, you know, too daunting for you, 5 days. If 5 days feel too daunting, just try 3 days. But basically look at when and where you're most likely to be tempted. So what is it, a time of day? Is it in a particular context or situation? Give as much detail as you can. So what was the temptation? And then also, what was the emotion that you were feeling at the time? Mm. So was it boredom? Was it work, or boredom with work? Was it loneliness? That can often drive people to give in to temptations. Was it frustration or anger? Was it feelings of overwhelm? It's very, very interesting where we think that temptations happen in isolation. But when we start to map them over a course of a week, I promise you that certain patterns will emerge in your temptations, and you'll start to recognize, okay, there's certain times of day I'm most tempted. I'm most tempted in response to certain emotional triggers. Okay, that's interesting. And this isn't to make you overly concerned about them or worried, because we all give in to temptations. We're all human beings. I give in to temptations. We all do. But it's more actually awareness and just power, and it's empowerment. And so by knowing a little bit more about your patterns, by knowing more about your drivers, you can start to ask yourself questions like, okay, so say stress is a primary driver for you. Okay, well, what's happening at this time that's stressful for you? And is there anything else that you can do at that time that might help you overcome that stress? So you can keep the cue or the trigger the same. You know, it might be a certain time of day, might be a certain situation, but you can look at changing the behavior. So maybe it's that stress causes you to go out and raid the biscuit jar, or whatever it happens to be. Is there something else you can do at that time? Like, can you take 3 minutes, boil the kettle for a cup of tea, and just take some long, deep breaths? You know, can you go and step outside for a minute? Now, that's not to say you have to do that every day. You might still have the biscuits every other day, and that's absolutely fine. But if you're having the biscuits, not out of pleasure, but out of stress, there's something to be questioned there. And, you know, it might not be biscuits for everyone. It might be that they get frustrated with one of their colleagues at work, or different things. But what I would say is track your temptations for a week, see what emotion is coming up, and then just start to experiment with alternative behaviors. Because the best way to kind of break unhelpful habits is actually to crowd them out with more helpful habits. So if you can start to increase things in your life that actually relieves, it's just going to make it less that you're actually going to give in to temptation. And then if you can couple that with removing the temptations from your environment, then it makes it harder, or increases the friction for you actually to engage with those temptations. That can be a really, really helpful way, and actually make it easier for you to try out and experiment with the new things in a kind of a safe environment where the temptations aren't that obvious.
It's so interesting, Heather, and you almost took some of the words out of my mouth as you were speaking. I was like, yes, and I agree. Because I think sometimes when we use the word temptations, it's associated with negative things. And as you said, we all have temptations, and it's perfectly okay to have them some of the time. They're giving us joy and pleasure, and we've got to think and ask ourselves these internal questions like, why am I doing this? And if it is for more of a negative reason, what other tools can we put in our toolkit to help us out and to support us with making changes to increase positivity within our life?
Yeah, and I think what you touch on there is so important. Like, all behaviors serve a purpose, you know, and we moralize them by calling them good or bad habits or whatever it happens to be, but they all serve a purpose. And I definitely would be guilty of saying bad habits or good habits every now and again. I try and reframe, but in our kind of colloquial, or it's in our vernacular, isn't it? But, you know, every habit serves a purpose. If we can get curious about, well, what is making me want to feel this? See, that knowledge, that is self-investigation, that we can all become behavioral scientists. We just need a little bit of curiosity about our own personal behaviors and look at, well, what emotion or situation or person or time of day or cue or trigger is driving us at that time. And the more we can gather this information on ourselves, the more empowered then we can be in terms of our decision making.
And we've mentioned the word a couple of times now, which is habit. So Heather, what is a habit?
Great question. There's a couple of definitions on this. I kind of like to go with that they're non-conscious processes. Mm-hmm. They're formed through something called context-dependent repetition. So do the same thing in the same circumstance enough times and it becomes a habit. And so a typical example of this would be, you know, you get in your car, that's a cue to sit in the seat and you put on your seatbelt, and the reward you get for that is feeling safe while you drive. And so habits are formed through a loop, which is dependent on a cue or a trigger. So that would be kind of getting into the car, the behavior, which is putting on the seatbelt, and the reward being feelings of safety. And, you know, over time, if you repeat that often enough, it becomes non-conscious. So it's not like you're walking down to the car and you're thinking, oh, I'm super motivated to wear my seatbelt today, or I'm a seatbelt kind of person today, or I'm in a seatbelt mood. You just do it. It's a non-conscious habit. And that's why we can form helpful habits over time that we don't even have to think about after enough repetition, but also why we can form unhelpful habits. A common one that people have at the moment is they're stuck on a project with work. They feel feelings of frustration, they whip out their phone, they start scrolling on a newsfeed to get a feeling of relief or from the boredom. But then the next time you are frustrated, your brain thinks of that as a cue. And so therefore it's like, oh, what did I do the last time? Oh yeah, I remember I scrolled on my newsfeed. And that's all well and good if that's something that you wish to do. It's not necessarily a restorative break. And actually often feelings of frustration are because you need space and you need more to think. And if you can step away from the screens for a little while, that can really, really help. She help your brain compound what's going on and actually construct things in a rest and recovery kind of point of view. But you can see over time, if you keep repeating a behavior in response to a cue, it'll become a non-conscious process. So you won't even think about it next time you're stuck in a project. You will have your phone out. You'll be scrolling on a newsfeed. And so that's the reason why, you know, the awareness piece is so important when we're trying to deconstruct unhelpful habits and when we're trying to construct helpful habits.
Yeah. And as you say, so say your go-to is scrolling on your phone, you know, that's okay sometimes. But as we were saying before, what other tools can you add into that kit that you may also enjoy doing that may also give you time out? Maybe it's going for a walk. It could be going and sitting on a park bench and getting your book out. Maybe it's doing some yoga or calling a friend. There's lots of other options that we can do to add variety.
And as well, once you do them once, you kind of prove to yourself that you can do something else. And I think that's the beauty. It doesn't have to be this or nothing. I always say that for people when they're, a lot of people, when they start to try and create running habits, for example, they'll go to go for one of their first runs and it's raining outside. Well, welcome to UK. It's going to rain. You've got to think about what's my plan in this situation? What would I do? And you can either go out there, put on your headphones, put on a killer playlist and feel an absolute boss running in the rain. You could buy a rain jacket for your next run. You could try out a strength training for runners online workout. The important thing is that it doesn't become all or nothing. And the key thing with our habits is it's repetition that breeds the habit. It's repetition that gets us that non-conscious state. So we don't even think about putting on the seatbelt. We don't even think about brushing our teeth. We don't even think about having a cup of tea or whatever it is. We don't have to motivate ourselves into doing those things. And the key thing there is we need to kind of create those plans. We need to create those alternatives. And in psychology, it's called implementation intentions or if-then plans. So if I'm trying to form a running habit and I go to go outside and it's raining, then what are other options available to me? And I would say to everyone, experiment with a couple of different options, because once you kind of do something once, it shows your brain that it isn't rain or no run. Mm. It's not all or nothing. It's not just one behavior, or that there are alternatives available. And again, you might not find the right thing straight away. That online workout that you do, you might not be the instructor, so you might want to try another one. Or, you know, you might try and go later in the day, but actually later in the day doesn't really work for you. It's better to kind of do it the next morning. Whatever it happens to be, a certain level of flexibility is absolutely fine in any habit change. The key thing is that we get away from this black or white thinking. Yeah. Nothing thinking, and actually we are able to weather that habit storm in regardless of what life throws at us.
Absolutely. And the all or nothing thinking and mentality we quite often speak about within nutrition as well, and supporting people with achieving a balanced lifestyle. We don't always have to eat the perfect balanced plate. In fact, when we do that, it can turn into us being too healthy, which in itself is unhealthy. So it's about giving ourselves those things that we enjoy in life. I have a question, and it's how long does it take to form a habit?
Okay, yeah. Well, the first thing is, how long does it take to form a habit? It's not 21 days, we all think. And that's a bit sad, actually, because wouldn't it be great if it was? And actually, that comes from anecdotal research from the 70s. It's from the plastic surgery field. And actually, it was around studies where they looked at, well, how long it took people to adapt to their new appearance post-surgery. And for some reason, that got extrapolated out to apply to habit change. But actually, the more recent research from University College London, they found it takes anything between 66 and 122 days, depending on how complex. Yeah, so depending on how complex a habit is. So the simpler, the smaller, the easier habits, those are the ones that get formed quicker. Mm-hmm. And I would say, if we want to think about the 3 month mark, that tends to be a good kind of average to kind of go off. That said, and this kind of goes back to the principle of, it's got to be small, it's got to be easy, it's got to be bite-sized, because that's what's going to help make habits stick. That means that you're not going to rely on your unreliable willpower, and it means much more that you're actually going to be able to repeat a habit often enough. And if we know that their habits are developed through context-dependent repetition, we want to be able to have that repetition to tell our brains, okay, this is something we'll engage in repeatedly. And therefore, those are the habits that are adopted the quickest, that are the smallest and the simplest. And I think they looked at, and I'm not sure if it was UCL, I can't remember the exact study, but they looked at flossing habits, and they looked at getting people just to floss, create a floss habit, versus they actually looked at getting people to floss one tooth. And the people that actually floss the one tooth at a time were much more to sustain the flossing habits than those that were just to that just had to create flossing habits. And the reason being, because one tooth almost felt like a joke when they were doing it, because it was so easy. But like I said before, friction is very important when it comes to habit change. And if we can lower the friction to engagement, it makes it more likely that we'll actually engage with it in the first place. And so people thought, well, one tooth is easy, come on, I can do that. And they would kind of get stuck in. And obviously, while they were there, they were like, well, one tooth's a bit silly, let's keep going. Whereas if they felt like they had too big a mountain to climb, like so many of us do, you know, we think January rolls around and we're like, right, I'm going to get sugar, I'm going to run every day, I'm going to be nice to my other half, I'm going to be super productive at work, I'm not going to read my emails till after lunch. You know, we add in, you know, the more we add in, the more we take away. It's a concept in goal dilution, actually. So we dilute the effectiveness of the focal goal.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the more we try and do with our habits, the more habits we try and add in all at once, the less likely we are to be successful. And that's what they found in these studies, this simpler. And that can be any type of habit. It can be a productivity habit, a sleep habit, a diet habit, a exercise habit, whatever habit. Mm-hmm. But we have one kind of willpower resource. So willpower is like a muscle. So say I went to the gym for the next week and just lifted weights on my left bicep. By the time I got to the end of the week, I wouldn't be able to pick up a cup of tea with that hand. But if I went once a week for 7 weeks, I get stronger over time. And I gave myself adequate rest and recovery. And that's much more habit forming. But the problem, we have most of our motivation at the start. So we're super enthused, we're super excited. And we burn ourselves out. We burn our willpower out. We deplete our willpower too much at the start. And then we don't leave ourselves for any willpower when we need it most. And actually what we need to do when it comes to forming habit change is do the opposite. We need to start with small, and I would say laughably small changes. And we need to execute on them consistently. And I am not joking when I say laughably. I say, if you don't giggle, if it doesn't pass the giggle test, if you don't giggle at how laughably small, like flossing one tooth, if you don't giggle at how small it is, then maybe it's not small enough. And I know I'm on a rant now, but I've just thought of something else. But another question to ask yourself as well, to really check in if your habit change is small enough, if that step you're taking is small enough, that it's not going to deplete your willpower, is to ask yourself on a scale of 1 to 100, how confident will you be that you'll still be able to create this laughably small change a week from now? And if you're not at least 70% confident, then you need to make it easier on yourself. So maybe you said you do it every day. Maybe it's every other day. Maybe it's Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And even better, if you want to get bonus points, you can ask yourself, will my most exhausted self still be executing on this goal? Is this easy enough that my most tired, depleted, stressed out, exhausted self will be able to do this? And that's because at some stage or another, we're all going to feel that. That is life. We're human. And so it's really important that we actually set up our habits that they can actually be resilient in all circumstances. Because again, we have to understand the bias, the motivation bias that we have at the start is going to make us believe that we're going to be superhuman in the future. And we actually fail to actually really understand that actually our future selves are, they're not perfect. And so we need to be our future selves' best friend right now, and actually believe in the flaws of our future self and help support them to not go off track.
Absolutely. And going back to the start there about bite-sized changes, I couldn't agree more. And I guess it links in with that all or nothing thinking. So for example, if you're trying to add more nourishing things into your diet, maybe it's trying to add in a piece of fruit every other day. You know, if you currently have no fiber in your diet or very limited fiber, you're not going to suddenly start eating 30 grams of fiber a day for so many reasons. Firstly, if your diet currently does not have it in it, you may not enjoy the foods that are rich in fiber. It's going to cause a lot of GI problems because we need to gradually build to that. So maybe it might be choosing a piece of fruit that you enjoy and having it every other day, and then maybe choosing a veg and adding that in on the other days and slowly building it up, making it achievable for yourself. And a lot of what you're talking about as well was, I thought about being kind to yourself. You're trying to make these changes to enjoy your life more, to live the best life that you can live. So be kind to yourself. You know, if something's not working, change it, do something that will work for you.
I think what you say there is so important in terms of habit change. Self-compassion, I always call it the secret habit that you need to develop if you want to have any sort of long-term success. And it's certainly something we've seen in the long-term maintainers. They didn't see failure as a personal success. They saw it as almost a system failure. As in, I left myself too hungry that time, the system failed. Or I was too vulnerable in that situation, the system failed. Rather than, I've eaten perfectly all week and now on Wednesday I've had a bar of chocolate and I might as well throw it out the window and I'll start again on Monday. They didn't see it as a failing of their willpower or a failing of them as a human. They saw it as, okay, well, how can I learn from this failure? What can I pick up from this? And that just shows reams and reams of self-compassion. And the funny thing is, there's a huge bias in society around self-compassion, self-care, self-kindness, whatever you want to call it. But essentially, we think that, oh, if we're kind to ourselves, well, we're just going to sit in our PJs and eat pizza and watch Netflix all day. And ultimately, that could be fun for a day, maybe, but that's not what self-kindness is about. And actually, in studies, they found that those that have the most compassion are actually the people that are most to stick with their goals. They're least likely to procrastinate. They have lower levels of stress, rumination, anxiety, depression. They have higher levels of self-esteem. They have lower levels of body dysmorphia, eating disorders, all sorts of medical markers. And it's really quite interesting because basically they're the type of people that cut themselves some slack. And not some slack in terms of, okay, I've fallen down here. I am a human being after all. We're all going to fail. And it's something I tell anyone, everyone on my program, and I'm like, welcome to the failure party, because we're all going to fail and we want to get used to it quickly. But they talk about, well, they're the type of people that say, okay, I'm going to fail, but how am I going to learn from this? Because each failure is a success if you can learn from it. And so they examine these failures with that kind of helicopter view that I was talking about when we're doing our temptation tracking. They looked at when they gave into temptation, why did they give in, and what were other alternatives or options that they could try in the future to overcome this? And that's really, really a compassionate approach to failure. Rather than kind of beating yourself with a big stick and telling yourself, well, I'm worthless, I'm never going to be able to be someone who follows my goals or anything else like that. It's actually a much more constructive coping mechanism, and it can really help people keep going with their goals.
Absolutely. It's the power of self-kindness. Kind of on the other side of what we were just talking about, which was forming habits, how quickly do we break habits?
Interesting. I'm not sure there's any particular research on this about a time point, I would say there's actually a really nice phrase from James Clear, his author of Atomic Habits, which says, never miss twice, which is we can miss on our habits one day, but when we start missing the next day, then the new habit becomes not doing the habit. And ultimately, the thing is with habits, if you're no longer following them, they're no longer a habit. You know, it's, and I would say it's not we brush our teeth just for January and then we expect dental hygiene for the rest of the year. We need to keep engaging with something in order for it still to be a habit. But if we do miss, the key thing is to pick ourselves up and ask ourselves, why did I miss in this situation? Was it that I was too restrictive on myself? So some people might say to themselves, oh, well, I have to go to the gym every morning this week. Again, that's too big. Mm-hmm. Let's make it three mornings. And let's not say you have to go Monday, Wednesday, Friday, because in studies they've shown if you just go 3 out of 7 days, rather than actually specifically stressing yourself out and feeling if you don't go on a Wednesday, you're a failure. They've actually shown that a certain degree of flexibility in terms of habit change is very, very important. So 3 days out of 7, whatever those 3 days that seem to fit work, do pick a time of day that you feel is going to be most beneficial. If it's an exercise habit, there's studies show that it is mostly beneficial to try that in the morning, but you may not be a morning person, so that's absolutely fine. And don't try and do things that are counter to who you are. And this goes back again to being your own behavioral scientist and actually knowing yourself, knowing your own behaviors, knowing what makes you accountable, knowing what times of day work for you. And the only way to get there is through a multiple series of failures or experiments, as I like to call them, because that feels a kinder way to talk to ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the things that I'm like picking up about forming sustainable habits have been making them small, making them bite-sized, making them things that we enjoy, and having to experiment around and finding those things that we do enjoy, having self-kindness and self-compassion, having flexibility, and just understanding yourself, asking yourself questions. Why did that not work? And when it does work, why did that work? And what can I now learn from that to implement into other changes?
Yeah, what a great summary. I would also say on the joy piece, I think this is so important. I'm so glad that you brought it up because, for example, say we're trying to form an exercise habit and people think of, okay, well, the first thing that pops into most people's heads are, okay, I'm either going to go running, or if I go to the gym, I'm going to look for the hardest machine possible. And what's really interesting, and I'm sure you experience this all the time, but when people think about eating a healthier diet, they think, okay, I'm just going to have steamed vegetables, salads, right? And there's a really interesting study from Kathy Milkman, and she wrote a great book called How to Change. And they looked at people choosing what exercise or diet they thought was most beneficial versus those that chose the exercise or diet that they felt they most would enjoy. And those that chose the one that they most enjoyed, they showed signs of being the ones that were actually most likely to be able to carry that out long term. And that's the thing. And people always say, what diet works? What thing works? You know, the diet, it's not necessarily, I'm not mad for the word diet, but the nutritional choices that you make, they've got to be the ones that suit you within your lifestyle, but they've got to be the ones that you enjoy, because the habits that you enjoy are the habits that you stick with. And so if we go in to the gym and say, well, I'm actually just going to pound the treadmill because that feels the hardest thing and therefore it must be the most beneficial, that's not necessarily going to be the thing that we stick with. And that's why we often fail. And so when people start off in their healthy habit journey, I often ask them, could they make space for maybe a bit of joy? So could they write a joy list? Could you write down all of the healthy habits that bring you joy, or any of the healthy habits that you currently engage with? Why do you enjoy them? And maybe, you know, it's things like, well, you don't necessarily enjoy walking, but you enjoy walking when you listen to an audiobook, or you enjoy it when you listen to a podcast, or when you go with a friend. So maybe it's about layering enjoyment onto the activities that you currently do. Doing your batch cooking while you're watching your favorite Netflix series or whatever it happens to be. Those can be little motivations to help you engage. But it really, really important, like you said, to find joy in your healthy habits, because those habits that you enjoy are ultimately the ones that you'll stick
with. Oh, I love that. And I love the sound of writing a joy list. I'm going to go do that after recording this episode. I really want to get on to talking about fad diets in a second. But as we've been talking, I've been thinking about right at the start, we spoke about when you go to the car, when you open the car door, you're not thinking, oh, I'm going to put my seatbelt on for all these reasons. You do it. For me, my trigger, if I'm having a day where I'm like, oh, I don't have the energy to do it today, I go have a shower. soon as I've had a shower, I feel refreshed, I feel ready, and it just changes my mental attitude towards everything. For me, the shower is my trigger to changing that day.
Yeah, so to reframe in a way as well. I've seen this used in acceptance commitment therapies where they, you know, you go and have a shower and you essentially wash away all of those feelings of maybe overwhelm or stress and often physically and mentally refreshed. So yeah. I love that. That's brilliant.
So interesting that there's research there as well. Honestly, it works for me. I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear from our listeners what they think works for them.
Oh, I'd love that.
So a couple of questions that I have for you, coming more onto the diet aspect of it. Again, I don't like that word either.
And actually, it's interesting the word diet, because the studies have shown that when they, and these are really archaic psychology studies, but basically when they flash up the word diet, and people get exposed to the word, they overcompensate then after the study in terms of their eating. Or when people are told that they're gonna have to diet and like the next week or the next Monday, people overcompensate over on the weekend because it's that anticipated deprivation that word brings about for people. So it has a lot of connotations for many, many people, and a lot of people hold a lot of trauma around it, micro traumas around that word.
So on that, why then have things like fad diets become so popular?
Because I believe behavior change is hard. And so we're all looking for that silver bullet. We're like, this is hard work. There must be an answer out there that something's got to be easier. And unfortunately, there isn't. And what I would say to people is we often spend our lives searching for that silver bullet or that secret sauce. I think it's just something that I say to people on my course, but I think it's time to understand that you are the secret sauce. Only you can change your habits. And it's through getting to know yourself, understanding your own personal behaviors, and then being supported with evidence-based tools as a scaffold to actually give you, and like you said, Amelia, those tools in your tool belt to support you with both the skills and the knowledge and the confidence to then consistently execute on your behaviors. So I think we're all looking for a quick win. We're all looking for an easy way through. And why not? Because it's so hard. And a lot of us really, really care about making differences in our lives. And that's why we feel so disheartened. And that's why we look for these fads and why they hook on people's, you know, pain points in their lives. But ultimately what we know from the research is, and actually it's one of the reasons that inspired me to start my business, is because we know conclusively from the research that long-term diets do not lead to long-term weight maintenance. And in fact, they actually lead to long-term weight gain. And the faster the weight is lost, the more likely it is that the more weight will be regained than pre-diet. And then a lot of that is to do with the feelings of deprivation and stress that we are engaged with in a diet. And so it's just really, really important that people understand that actually a lot of these fad diets, they're not evidence-based. They're usually based on N of one. They're usually based around celebrities that actually, you know, get paid to be a certain weight for a certain movie or have to present in a certain way for a short period of time. And actually what that gets talked about less is actually the metabolic effects that it has on these people. There's quite an interesting study on it. Those people that were in the Biggest Loser competition, I think it was, and actually the negative impact that it's had on their BMR. I think in the study, someone's BMR had gone down to 850 calories a day. So that's how much energy they burn. Rest, isn't it? You would probably know this better than me.
Your basal metabolic rate.
Now, calories aren't always the mass to weight gain, because it's other nutrients in the food that you eat, and you know, more and more that the calories kind of research is getting kind of investigated in terms of its efficacy. But it's just an interesting marker to show us that these kind of quick bad diets are just ineffective. And you know, besides the physiological effects, the psychological effects are huge. They make you feel worthless. You feel like you can never ultimately succeed. And you know, that's not a nice place.
And then it's contributing to a poor relationship with food and seeing food just as calories. Food is so much more than the calories in it. It provides us with energy and joy. It provides us with so many different nutrients. You know, it provides us with all of those cues, the smell of food, the excitement that you're going to, you know, on a Sunday, you're going to be having a roast dinner, or maybe it's a Wednesday that you're having your roast. You're doing whatever you're enjoying. But kind of on that note, I guess this may come into more external cues and focusing on them. I don't know if you have any thoughts about this, But considering your research, and I think you did something about people feeling deprived and restricted, and recently within the media, there's been a lot of attention, especially over summer, on the addition of calories to menus. Do you have any thoughts about this that you could share with us? And maybe especially for people who are feeling a bit nervous about it.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because I've read studies on it being effective and I've read studies on it being ineffective. And again, it comes back to the behavioral principle of there is no one size fits all. And it's mm-hmm. about the size that works for you. And so if you find it triggering, it's not necessarily going to be something that's beneficial, but I would investigate why it is that you find it triggering and what is it about this that actually throws you off course? Is it that when you want to go out for a meal, you don't want to think about these things and you know, it's important for you to feel free mm-hmm. from those various bits and pieces? Or and I think you're allowed request menus without calories on them mm-hmm. if in those circumstances. I'm not 100% sure because they quite sorted out the nuts and bolts of it, yes. But for other people, they see it as an informative choice. Again, I don't know how you would feel about this, but for me, it would be less about the calories and more about the sources of the calories. Because for me, it's more about, from a nutritional standpoint, if I'm trying to make a nourishing choice, and then that's not necessarily what I always want to do when I go out for dinner. Like you say, you know, sometimes I just want to get whatever I want to, I feel like in the moment, or whatever feels joyful for me. And I want to eat it mindfully and I want to have the best time and I just want to have that taste experience. But other times, I might want something that I want to have, something that brings you the most nourishment. Because if I get avocado and some nut loaf, let's just say, that's going to be high in terms of calories. But in terms of nourishment, it's going to be so different. And I really don't believe in calories, to be honest, because I just think that they're not really teaching anything from a nourishment point of view. And if anything, they exacerbate this focus on counting, tracking, controlling in a way that is actually losing the point, which is the nourishment that we get from mm-hmm. food. So yeah, I think it's hard for people because that's not what some people in the general public really understand and know. I think Tim Spector's work on this is really quite interesting. But yeah, but I'd be interested in hearing your opinion on it too.
Thank you, Heather, for sharing your thoughts on that. No, I couldn't agree more. Food is meant to be nourishing and to provide us with all of those nutrients to help us live the most sustainable, positive life that we can. And it's definitely not as simple as putting it down to a calorie. Mm. I mean, for so many reasons, all the reasons that you just stated, it misses the point of what else is in that food. And it also misses the point of we need calories, we need energy. So yeah, it's really just not that easy to simplify it down to that small. And as you say, it would be it's a very different choice to having, what was your example? Was it nut butter or an avocado toast? That's going to provide you with fatty acids that we need for our brain. It's going to provide us with fiber. It's going to provide us with, I mean, different vitamins, versus maybe something that's more of a refined grain, something that has a lot less fiber in it. But at some points, we also need these. You know, you might be about to go on a run, or you may not have a chance to eat later in that day. So that is what you need at that point. It's not as simple as just the food. It's the circumstance you're in that day. It's, are you there for what reason? What's that meal going to do for you that day? And I guess it comes down to you know you best. And it's not as simple as a number. So I'm aware that we're coming to the end here, but it's been fascinating. Honestly, Heather, I could talk to you so long about habits, but just to sum up a couple of questions about you, what is next for you on your journey within behaviour change?
Oh, great question. I think I'm really focused on my course at the moment. I've been talking to a lot of my course participants and I'm interested in what struggles they have along the way on their journeys and what they're finding that works and what they're finding that doesn't. And a lot of them say to me immediately, disarmed me, because I'm not allowed to make all the changes all at once. And it's quite interesting how people have to actually unlearn past behaviors and then they're relearning these new behaviors. And it's incredibly motivating, but also initially kind of it was frustrating for me, and why I wrote the course and do this work in the first place, that people don't know these things. We all think like, you know, a lot of what we do is completely counter to actually what is most effective, what studies have shown. And I'm not saying trust me, I'm saying trust the research. You know, we've done these empirical studies, we've tested this on hundreds of people. And what I've done for my course is I've just gathered all the data together and presented people with, to my best knowledge, the evidence base that's out there at the moment that's going to best support maintenance of long-term behaviors. So I'm quite excited about that at the moment, actually.
Very exciting. And your course is called Bite Size Habits?
Yeah.
Lovely. And would you be able to send us, to put in the links to this podcast, some resources or some of those studies for if people wanted to go do some more reading or listen to maybe a talk or something?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I've actually got a free 5-day video course that kind of summarizes all the key research that people might find kind of accessible and fun.
Well, we'll definitely link that in the description for this podcast for anyone looking to find it. And a final question, which I ask all of my guests, Heather, is could you please sum up for us in a sentence, a few words or a quote, any advice that you would give to people on their own lifestyle behaviour change journey?
Oh, great question. I'm not, as you can tell, I'm not very good at being brief, but I would say it's something that we talked about time and time again on this call, but it's find joy, because the healthy habits you enjoy are the ones that you stick with. And ultimately, why wouldn't we want a joy-filled life?
I love that. Thank you so much, Heather.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Heather, for joining me today, sharing your journey and research with us. It was great to talk with you about how to tailor our environments to be more successful in achieving our goals and forming long-term sustainable habits. This included choosing bite-sized habits, which passed the giggle test, and the importance of practicing kindness and self-love, choosing activities which we enjoy. You can find Heather and more information about creating habits online by searching for drheathermckee.co.uk and also her free 5-day video challenge called The Bite Size Habits. It's focused on evidence-based ways to kickstart your healthy habit success, and it can be found at www.bitesizehabits.co. And thank you to all of you who have joined me on the journey of this podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, I'm sure you'll love what's coming next. So make sure you hit subscribe to be one of the first to hear. And if you love hearing about others' journeys and expertise as much as I love to share them, please give this podcast a 5-star review. It will help us to reach more people. I wish Heather and all of you luck on your journeys. I hope you join me again soon to discover more journeys in nutrition.